Wednesday of 10. And Nunes is an absolute magician. He's set up.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. With you as always, Steve Haller, and joining me as always, back in full effect, Christian DeGuzman and Andy Pregler. What's going on, guys?
No matter how bad we are at anything we do, don't worry, we can avoid losing games while no-hitting opponents.
I will not take any slander of the Pittsburgh Pirates' greatest achievement of the last 5 years, which is to win a game while not getting a hit. It really is the metaphysical answer to the question of how can you be bad, but at the same time not be bad, that the Pirates want to exist in for their entire franchise's life.
It also answers the metaphysical question of describe a Reds versus Pirates game.
The only thing it was missing was a fight, a benches clearing brawl for no reason whatsoever.
Yeah, that is
the Pirates and Reds are chronically mad online, and this year's team is so new because both teams shipped off everybody good that they have yet to develop their online beef. But beef is brewing, and I'm sure that today helped a lot. But Steve, the real question that we have for you is women's lacrosse stuff. As Christian is our normal women's lacrosse person, I did not watch any bit of the ACC tournament in any way, shape, or form. I know that you published an article, you helped our wonderful lacrosse writer push live the recap. You helped John push the article out. Did you watch any of the game? Or were you just like, ooh, I'm going to take this as an opportunity to learn about what happened today?
No, I was actually, during the same time, tending to a four-year-old that had a fever, so I happened to be around when John when John decided to have the recap ready to rock. But as you can imagine, since it didn't start with tears, groans, and various other things, the women are advancing to next weekend. They will be they beat Princeton 13-9 today in the tournament after squeaking past Fairfield 12-11 in the first round. We're in survive and advance mode, so it doesn't matter how you win, as long as you keep winning.
Yeah, Christian, so I think one of the things that we have talked about all season long is that this was always the expectation for this team, and then the injuries continued to pile up, and we kind of saw the wheels not fall off at the end of the year, but they were rattling. You definitely looked, you got the low tire pressure warning coming on one of the lights. The check engine light was starting to blink in an inconsistent manner. But this women's lacrosse team had what I thought was a pretty wet fart way to end the season in the ACC tournament. Really the only way to describe it. And then all of a sudden they're coming out here and they're two wins into the NCAA tournament. So I guess the question for you is, before we go into the actual games part of it, this was always the expectation, but even after adjusting the expectations for everything that happened, because a lot did happen, is this still basically the floor for where we wanted? Or are we at the point now where we're like, oh, not quite playing with house money because we're Syracuse lacrosse. No one's ever going to think of us as like an underdog this early in the tournament. But like, oh, we're kind of doing more than we thought we were going to be doing right now.
Well, it sounds like Steve has had some recent experiences with wet farts that don't involve him.
come for the sports commentary, hang around for the poop jokes. That's what we're here for, folks.
So to adjust the expectation, I don't think is necessarily a thing that Syracuse ever thought they were going to do. So I think we are still pretty much actually not even at the floor yet. I think for this Syracuse team, while they did lose to their next opponent, Northwestern, during the regular season, this is still a Syracuse team that expects to beat Northwestern and get back to the Final Four. I think for just in general, Syracuse expects to get to the Final Four. And so while the injuries will probably make a loss in the Elite Eight not feel as bad, it will still stink for a program that has aspirations of getting back to Memorial Day weekend, like it has done so for pretty much the entirety of the past 10 years. So, given though the injuries have slowed down the offense a bit, and that has completely shown in the first couple of tournament games, I think the expectation from this program is, even despite the injuries, it's still a Final Four team that should make the Final Four.
And yeah, the thing coming out of this, though, is we got to make the Final Four going through going to a place that we historically haven't played amazingly at. Seeing Syracuse will be traveling on Thursday, I believe, to Northwestern. So a familiar foe, a historically good foe, and it's going to be a test to get back to, well, the tail end of Memorial Day weekend in this case.
Yeah, so for those who might be wondering, what are the Elite Eight of the Women's Lacrosse tournament? It is the aforementioned Syracuse, the aforementioned Northwestern. The Syracuse is the 5 seed, Northwestern is the 4 seed. 8 seed Stony Brook advanced, number 1 seed North Carolina advanced, 7 seed Florida, 6 seed Loyola Maryland, number 3 seed Boston College, number 2 seed Maryland. So pretty much we've got a very chalky bracket here. And obviously, if the chalk were to continue, Northwestern would be the team beating Syracuse in next week's matchup. But before we get to previewing that a little bit, let's talk about what Syracuse did. As alluded to by Steve, in the first round, Syracuse almost lost to Fairfield. They eked out a single goal win, 12-11. The second round game was a 13-9 victory over Princeton after a really slow start. They needed to come back for that game. The cardiac cuse has now been inherited by the women's lacrosse team. Christian, what have been the struggles for the women's lacrosse team in both of these games, and how have they managed to overcome them?
So it's basically what you alluded to at the beginning of this. It's the injuries have just piled up for Syracuse lacrosse, to the fact where the offense is actually starting to slow down, and that's just due to the amount of injuries that have been suffered on the offensive end. Emma Ward, Emma Tyrell, Sierra Cockrell, the big ones that just, while you still have the three-headed monster of Cherish, Chuck, Tyrell, and Carney up top, I mean, in women's lacrosse, you need all the players on offense to be working as a great unit in order to establish a good flow and put the ball in the back of the net consistently. And the three of them just can't do it by themselves. I mean, it's the epitome of a team sport. So the offense has slowed down a bit. And really, what's carried this team is the defense. The defense has been looking pretty good so far, which is something that I don't think a lot of Syracuse fans would have pointed to at the beginning of the year. Of course, just with all the names on offense and then losing last year Asa Goldstock due to graduation, you're coming in with a fresh goalie unit and basically facing the same problem that the men did, you know, trying to figure out who's going to be a starter in goal and who's going to stay a starter in goal. And so there have been some fluctuations in goal for Syracuse, but now Kim Kimberhauer has, you know, really cemented that spot in the goal for Syracuse, which is been big. Like, not, it hasn't been like with the men's team where Bobby Gavin and Harrison Thompson really can't eke out an advantage over one another. Kimber Howard's actually just, you know, solidified that spot now. And she and the defense have been holding strong, which is basically what you need to do in this NCAA tournament and just NCAA tournaments in general. Defense wins championships, and the defense is starting to show up.
Yeah.
There's so many suburban dads who just heard that phrase and subtly smiled, knowing that defense wins champions is still an appropriate thing to say in today's modern sports analytics era.
He was going to tattoo that onto the CBS.
No, absolutely. No, offensive line wins championships. Ask the Kansas City Chiefs.
That's a very good point. You make a very, very good point there.
Cannot argue with that. Yeah, that is not. Listen, I'm glad that the women's lacrosse team is managing to fight through these injuries, but it does kind of feel like, hey, you got through the opening level and you lost a life when you didn't really expect to. Now here comes the actual like part of the game. You're not in the warm up spot anymore. So a little bit less than ideal with the bodies that the Syracuse women's lacrosse program is dealing with. But they are not the only lacrosse program to be dealing with injuries on the hill right now. The men's lacrosse team has had a heck of a week when it comes to losing bodies, both due to injuries and due to transfers.
I was trying to see where you were going on that one. There's a nice roundabout transition. I like that.
Yeah, I had to go roundabout there. Christian, there's, you alluded to it right before we got on. This week was strangely busy, no pun intended, and this was a week of the transfer portal rearing its wonderful head, both for good and for bad.
Yeah, so let's start because, I mean, this wouldn't be a Syracuse podcast if we didn't start with the bad. Let's start with the bad. Unfortunately, Syracuse loses another person who had a fairly, not a great year, but like a very serviceable year. Mateo Corsi is into the transfer portal. He had 2 goals against Duke, but hasn't played too much since. And he would have been a very good second midfielder next year. He was a freshman this year, and unfortunately, he's into the transfer portal. So it's Dordovic, Berkman, Jack Savage, and Mateo Corsi into the transfer portal. So it's not the biggest loss. The big thing, though, for Syracuse is the addition, landing a grad transfer from Denver named Alex Simmons. And he is a Canadian who is a former teammate of Owen Hiltz at Culver. So Canadian connection should be very good. And because of his addition, he played both attack and midfield. So you have an option. You can play him in a couple of spots. You'll probably play him in attack with the combination of Hiltz and Spallina next year, which should be pretty, pretty good. That's the big thing.
His versatility also, you know, leaves it a little better options as to what we can grab in the transfer portal too.
Yes.
You know, we don't have to focus specifically somewhere. It's like grab what you can get if you have enough versatility there.
Mm-hmm. And I just have to see if this guy hasn't moved yet, because there is a player who entered the transfer portal. I don't see anything new about him since. So the big news that came from the lacrosse world this year, in the past week, is a guy named Marcus Hudgens who entered the transfer portal. He's a close defender from Army. And he entered the transfer portal, didn't play last year, but before the season started, he was voted, I believe, as the preseason Patriot League Defender of the Year. Hmm. And he is a Syracuse kid. He was from West Jenny. And his father said to Syracuse.com that he is open to going to Syracuse, which would be a huge get. A couple of people have said online that Hudgens can transform our defense from bad to good or good to great. So he's that kind of a player that Syracuse would like to get, especially being a West Jenny kid. Right. You'd like to bring him back home.
Gimme.
Yeah, and again, he was a guy who was picked as a preseason first-team All-American by Inside Lacrosse last year. A potential Patriot League Defender of the Year who didn't play last year. But, as you know, in previous years, the Patriot League has some pretty good offenses. And if you can be a good defender in that league, you could probably be a good defender in the ACC. So that's the key name to look out for this week, Marcus Hudgens. And if he goes to Syracuse, that becomes a very big get for Syracuse, who hasn't really had an alpha defender since the days of Nick Mellon and Scott Furman. They really need that alpha defender to come back into their fold.
Right.
And really rejuvenize the defense.
Yeah, that all tracks. And it's a good thing to keep updated on. I don't want to spend too much more time on this because I went through the website and saw all the other things that we need to hit this week.
Well, we do have one thing that we did miss on the women's side, though.
Yes, I was going to pivot to talking about elite players. Syracuse. Oh, yeah. Has one that is about to get nominated. Steve, can you pronounce it? Because I'm going to butcher it. Not her name, but like the award name. I'm terrible at this every time.
Go for it, Christian.
Kuartan.
That's what I was going with, so that works. I don't know if that's where Andy was, but...
No, that is not where I was, so we're just going to go with that. Megan Tyrell, Kuartan finalist. which is the highest honor that an individual player can receive in lacrosse for both men's and women's. The other finalists are Boston College's Charlotte North, who won the award last year, North Carolina's Jamie Ortega, Ali Mastrioni from North Carolina as well, and Maryland's Aurora Cordingly. The general vibe is that it's a really loaded field. I'm not sure that Tyrell is going to be like the odds-on favorite to win. Probably not, but it is an literally it is an honor to be nominated because you are recognized as one of the top five players in the sport. In general, this is something that if you look at the list of winners, Syracuse has a very long history of getting finalists and winners onto the Tuoroton trophy name. So. Congratulations to Tyrell for being added to that list.
Fortunately, Syracuse faces the big fat zero in the Tuoroton Award for women's, which is a shame. It's just that there have been some, it's a shame that there have been some great players who have been in their way. Right now, it's Charlotte North, and it's either going to be North or Ortega that wins the award this year. And when Kayla Traynor was playing, Taylor Cummings was a thing. Mm. And Taylor Cummings is widely regarded as one of the best ever to play women's lacrosse. And she always beat out Traynor for the award, which is just unfortunate.
Yeah, and I think even on the men's side, the last time we had a winner was what? Mike Lavelle, probably?
Was it JoJo? I don't know.
Did JoJo win?
I don't remember.
No, he's nominated.
I'm looking this up.
I'm very curious about this.
Okay. It is Mike Lavelle. JoJo would have been. Was JoJo. What year was
JoJo would have been the JoJo would have been 10 Thompson to 13, years, wasn't I think.
It? Okay. No. Oh, Pinnell. No, he was Rob Pinnell.
Yeah, Pinnell. That'll Steel Stanwyck.
Yep.
those are good teams there.
Yeah, when you look at Cuse, it's literally Mikey, and Lavelle, and that's it that have ever because the award officially started in 2001.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you couldn't even get all the rest of the Powells and Gates on there.
Even though they probably should have been. congrats to Megan. And yeah, this sounds like some fun off-season topics of the Syracuse players to get nominated but not win. And would they have won if they had not run into the juggernauts that they had run into?
Or Sonego, we just gave you an article idea. Enjoy.
Yeah, there you go. We're gonna take a minute to do halftime here because we got men's basketball and men's football coming up after the break. So before we get to that, we want to say thank you to our good friends at Home Field Apparel, maker of the finest, comfiest vintage clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, even sweat joggers that you will find out there on the interwebs. The fine folks at Home Field Apparel just recently launched some new Syracuse gear. Previously, they had a Syracuse collection that I think a lot of you were pretty familiar with, and now we are looking at two new shirts. A orange vintage dome logo shirt and a 2003 national champion shirt. So, you know, those are things that Syracuse fans love to have in their collection, and Home Field Apparel has you covered. Use the promo code Nunes, NUNES, for 10% off your first order at Home Field Apparel. We appreciate their support and their continued sponsorship of the podcast. And so, as we think about the place that was the Carrier Dome, Michael, as usual, came up with a really interesting article idea, which is the idea that with the Carrier Dome undergoing certain renovations, there's a really good chance that attendance records could be impacted. Steve, I'm just kind of interested to hit you up here on this one because, one, I still don't quite understand the science of what they're doing inside of the dome with the seats versus the bleachers and how that impacts attendance. But then the second part is, big dome games. You've seen more of them than me.
A while for the Steve Azul joke.
There it is.
Zero.
Have you not been at any of the sellout record games?
Nope.
That None surprises of them. Me.
I don't really? Like people.
Okay, well, that's
well, that anytime you get into the situations where it was, you know, pack the dome or get as many people in here as possible, I'm like, I'm just going to watch it on my TV or go to my buddy's house because I love going to the dome, but I don't like that many people in the dome. So And even the Clemson game, I wasn't there because of the aforementioned wedding numerous times. So yeah, I have somehow missed, I think the only game that I was ever at that was remotely packed would have been a Nova game. I think it was the year before they had the push to bust the record, or it might have been the year after, yeah, where it was just like the teams were mediocre or whatever. But it was quite full. You know, we were probably 30,000 plus for basketball, but it wasn't like the complete can't move anywhere in the dome type situations.
Yeah. Very unexpected. But I kind of dig it. But in general,
when you're a former college offensive lineman, you don't fit in small spaces with a lot of people.
This is also fair. So what are your feelings on going from bleacher seating to, you know, traditional stadium seating then, as somebody who probably is not as comfortable in tiny stadium seats?
Strangely enough, because of the way people pack the dome, it's probably better to be in seats than it is to be in the bleachers. Just because you actually have a more defined space instead of a random number on a seat in front of you. I don't know. It's to me, it seems like it's a move that's been a long time coming. I know there's, you know, people that are yelling, get off my lawn about losing the bleachers. And, you know, I guess as long as we save the troughs, people will still be happy. But it's a weird situation where I think, personally, I'm much happier that we have, or that we're getting the seating. Yeah, it's going to cut down the opportunity to break records, but I think it'll be better for this experience overall, and just a better look for the dome. You know, a whole bunch of improvements. I don't know if anybody has contrary opinions on that, but that's where I sit.
No, I think that makes sense. But the teams that we could be theoretically packing them in for one last time have been announced. Earlier this week, we had, again, Kevin doing the work and figuring out the 2022-2023 ACC men's basketball information. We now know who Syracuse will play in a home-and-home, who Syracuse will play exclusively at home, and who Syracuse will play exclusively on the road. So this does not include the non-conference matchups. This is just the ACC. Syracuse will have home and homes against Boston College, Pitt Panthers, Georgia Tech, Notre Dame, Virginia, and Virginia Tech. They will play Duke, North Carolina, North Carolina State, and Wake Forest exclusively at the Carrier Dome. And they will play Clemson, Florida State, Louisville, and Miami exclusively on the road.
I think you're wrong there, Andy.
Am I wrong?
Yeah, they're not going to be playing a single team in the Carrier Dome.
Seeing
they, as of yesterday, officially took the sign down.
Yes, it is no longer the Carrier Dome, but it is not a, we do not have a new name for the stadium yet. Just the league.
It's the name goes here dome.
Yeah, we're trading for a player to be named later here.
You know those billboards they have on 690, like interested in ad space here, call 666.
That's just hanging from the one side of the dome at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm literally putting into the podcast description, the name goes here dome. I'm making that now. Thank you. You're 100% right. No one is coming to the, Carry Dome. They're all coming to the name goes here dome. Overall,
that's gotta be a thing until the official announcement. Now there's no other way.
All right. So let's tag Kevin and say, yeah, okay,
this is official.
From henceforth forth, every time we want to mention the dome in a Noon Suggestion article, it must be known as the name goes here dome.
Yeah, yep. this is now Noon 616 canon here. It's official.
Yes. well done, Christian. Well done. But the schedule, if you're a ticket holder, is probably great because you get a Duke game and you get a UNC game. It's great from a Syracuse scheduling perspective because we don't have to go to Duke. We don't have to go to UNC, even though Jim Boeheim has had more success down there than his other ACC compatriots. That being said, the Miami was an Elite Eight team last year. Florida State usually gives Syracuse fits, ACC tournaments notwithstanding. Duke, North Carolina, and Wake Forest were all really good last year, and so we still have to play them. And the home and homes are really, you know, Boston College, Pitt, Georgia Tech were all terrible, but Notre Dame, Virginia, and Virginia Tech were definitively not. So I think that either an ACC schedule is always going to be hard. But Kirsten, I'm just curious, that do you think that there's any benefit to only getting Duke, North Carolina, Wake Forest at home, as opposed to a home and home, or as opposed to only playing them on the road?
I actually think the road schedule isn't that bad, honestly. Like, you're avoiding Duke and Carolina is big, I think. And yes, you get the scariest ones are Notre Dame and Virginia. I'm not sure if Virginia Tech's gonna have the same kind of year that they did. It's same with Miami. So, it's an enticing road schedule. So, I think you're and to go back to kind of where this all started off with, there's some great home games to pack out the dome for. The home and homes, like Virginia, you'll probably get something there. Pittsburgh's up 2-1. Duke and North Carolina.
My fee is definitely behind.
No. No, they just scored on the power play. Yeah. Yeah. But Duke and North Carolina, you'll probably, obviously, those are your big opportunities to pack out the dome. Yeah. You'll probably get some good stuff there.
I'd be curious. Well, I'm pretty sure this was definitely some talks at ACC HQ of like, hey, we're gonna do some promo, farewell to the dome tour. We're getting these guys at home, and apparently, judging by the look of it, we don't believe in traveling to the state of North Carolina until the ACC tournament, and I don't even know if it's there this year. So
it is there this year. So this is probably Jim's. This was Jim's foot in the ground. Like, you're not getting me down here more than once.
Listen, I'm leaving after this year. I'm just completely making this up, but like, I'm leaving after this year. I'm only going down there once. There's no good food. It's fine.
And this goal's getting reviewed, by the way.
Yes, Christian. So for those who are wondering, Christian before the show said he really wants to get into hockey, and I told him, well, it's really hard because the refs suck. So there is a rule that they never explain until a goal happens, that they're reviewing it, where the stick, when you score, cannot be higher than the goal bar when held parallel, which is super, super confusing because you can have the stick up higher than the goal net, but like if it's mostly lower, it's fine. It's a whole very confusing, very interpretive rule that doesn't make a ton of sense. So I'm looking at this goal and I think it's going to be a good goal, but that just means that the goal is probably not going to be a good goal because I don't know anything about hockey, even though I've been following the sport for a very long time. So
that is
what I've learned. So basketball news is not done because there was more stuff besides the scheduling, because of course there was more than just the scheduling this week with men's basketball. Syracuse landed a backup center.
That was this week. Oh my god, I completely forgot.
Oh yeah.
And guess what? It's a great thing we're talking about Pittsburgh because that's where he's coming from. The Mornir Hema. That's how I'm gonna. Or is it? Nope. There's no R in there, so it's Mornir. Mornir Hema. Until corrected otherwise, he visited campus back to back days and then immediately committed. He is 6'11", and he is a rising sophomore, having originally committed to Duquesne and playing for Duquesne University. If you do not know Duquesne University, it is not a big school, but it is in Pittsburgh. Their program has been on the rise as of late. He played 9.6 minutes per game and averaged 1.9 points and 2.8 rebounds, starting five games, tallying 18.8 minutes, 3.6 points and 5.2 rebounds in those games. There seems to be, and this is something I want to call out to my friend Chari, it seems like the way that Syracuse hits the transfer portal is they only go after guys that they have connections with. They're not trying to establish a new recruiting pipeline through the transfer portal like some other schools are. And so Hema attended St. Benedict's Prep, which is the same school that Tyler Ennis and Barama Sidibe did as well. So that's a lot of words about the kid. Steve, I think what we all saw and heard was that Jim Boeheim has his toy project center.
It's a recurring theme. Apparently, Jim Boeheim is not allowed to have a year without a project center, going all the way back to was it Sean Johnson? Or no, that's you can probably even go farther back than that, but I can remember there was a numerous 7-foot centers that he just repeatedly will have on roster and then try to develop, and sometimes they work out and sometimes they just don't and they disappear. So I mean looks raw, looks long. Beyond that, I don't have any real like analysis of what he could be. I mean, he's just another long, lanky 7-footer that maybe we can turn into something.
Andy, I have bad news.
What's the bad news here?
I think you know the bad news. Watch your
stream. Oh, I do know the bad news, and I just saw it happen. Oh, that was a soft goal, Jari.
Look at the replay here of the crazy scramble that just happened in front of goal, just Sturkin on the ground. Well, that's what happens when your goalie doesn't play.
Anyone who's listening to this tomorrow, go back to the live feed at that timestamp and look at Andy's face. It was priceless.
But that's what happens when your goalie doesn't play in over a month. Sometimes these things happen.
Oh, and it was off of our own player, too.
It was off of Matheson's skate, yeah.
Yeah. That makes me really sad.
But to redirect the conversation back on Syracuse.
No, I was going to say, we were talking about Pittsburgh things that are underwhelming. Yeah. Hi, we're back on topic.
Yeah. It's tough to get a backup in the portal. Because everyone who goes into the portal wants a starting job. Unless you get someone who's like Saimir, right. Not his brother. You get someone like Saimir who is actually willing to like, who's actually like doing it so he can go back home. And is willing to take like a backup position. So like you don't get those players. Those players are a dime a dozen.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, it's either going to be a grad transfer that knows that they're, you know, knows what their role is going to be, or it's going to be somebody like this who's going to be a project.
Yeah. And so anyone who was expecting a world beater from the transfer portal when you're looking for a backup center, I think has to temper expectations, because that's just in general what Syracuse was always going to get from the portal for a backup center. Someone who is very raw and someone who is very, very unproven. And so it's the realities of what's happening here.
Yeah. I think it's just some schools have found a way to use the portal to their advantage. Most schools haven't quite figured it out yet. And I think that that's where Syracuse is. And Christian, you hit the nail on the head. I think we have to stop expecting Syracuse to go into the portal and get a person who's willing to come in and sit into Jim Boeheim's system.
Yeah.
We're either getting a starter or we're getting nothing. We're getting a Cole Swider, which is somebody who is going to play 38 minutes a night, whether you like it or not, or we're getting a project.
Mm-hmm.
So, definitely, I would not expect that this kid is going to play 28 or 38 minutes a night because Jesse Edwards exists and should be healthy. Yeah. So
if he develops, he could be a very serviceable guy, kind of like Pascal Chukwu was, kind of fits that frame. But as we saw with Chukwu, it took him 3 years to actually do something, and even then it was still kind of raw.
Yeah. Well,
for the record, Andy, you didn't hear it on the mic just because of the directionality of it, but I was knocking on wood so hard when you said he should be playing often and should stay healthy, because we're going to need it.
Yes, we are definitively going to need it there. Continuing with the transfer portal news, Steve, this is all you. Stephen Bailey tweeted out on May 12th that Syracuse offered 2022 JUCO O-lineman Makai Lee. Makai is allegedly has received 20 offers. However, Steve, you kind of did the work. Syracuse is the only P5 offer that he's got. And what's the deal with this kid? He's an offensive lineman. Where does he look? What does he look like? And what could potentially be the reasoning why Syracuse is trying to bring this kid in?
So at JUCO, he's been playing tackle. I believe, if I'm remembering right, Stephen Bailey had a tweet out about him playing inside or something along those lines. Either way, check out Steven's stuff because he always has a scoop on whatever. But looking at him, he's raw. He only has a P5 offer. I think there were a couple other like bigger name G5 sniffing around. I think Houston was in the mix, maybe some others, but he's decent run block technique, real rough in the pass. Curious if it's something that Schmidt thinks he can turn into a project, or that he sees something and thinks he can make work. I don't know what or where. Also, I didn't realize that was this week too. Much like our standard, wait, that happened. I could have sworn that was last week.
Well, so. We found the title of the podcast, Turning into Snaps with Podcast. Wait, that happened this week?
Yes. we could just title that every week. If you guys ever heard the pre-roll, it'd be, yeah. We're like, wait, what? That? Okay. So, but yeah, I mean, Lee looks like he's going to be, if he does commit to the orange, he looks like he's going to be not someone stepping right into the depth chart. But, you know, someone that has some ability if they're sniffing around. Other than that, I don't really, I don't know. Whether it's just to fill out a roster spot, I would have much preferred them to fill out the roster spot on the other side of the ball, where it seems like we're in much more need.
Well, we're converting Justin Hugh to a defensive lineman now. I think that was this week as well. Well, yeah. Not
Josh Ho.
Is that Josh Ho? Yeah. Josh's brother.
Yeah, yes. Exactly.
Or did he change? He changes names when he switches sides of the ball. That's the trick.
Exactly. but I don't think that was, like, we knew that he had both positionality, but I forget, was it this week the tweet came out with, like, him officially being listed as a D lineman, and he was...
That might have been a week ago. I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. But it seems like things are moving around in weird ways, which is not uncommon for a Dino Babers team this time of year. They really do seem to like to mess with positional flexibility early in players' careers, which I think is better than later in players' careers. But you definitely get some wonky changes in looks just based off of where the roster's shaken out.
Well, for years we've talked about Huff being Rhino, and we didn't realize that it was going to be in this sense. I don't think this was how we wanted him to be, Rhino. I think we were looking more for the running back side of the ball. But hey, if it works out, I'm fine with it. I don't know. It's one of those where they see them much more often than us, and there's been plenty of people that, you know, especially a running back switching to D-line, you know he's going to have the athleticism to do at least something. So we'll see how that one pans out as the actual season progresses.
Well, we know that the reason that they do this is because depth has been a consistent issue for the Dino Babers teams, and that depth took a big hit this past week at the quarterback position. Another thing that happened this week, Justin Lampson, the presumed backup quarterback to Garrett Schrader this year, suffered a non-contact knee injury that required surgery. None of those are good. Your best case scenario is ACL, MCL kind of deal, and you're out maybe 9 months if you're lucky.
As someone who has knees that aren't all intact, it's present. Your best bet is an MCL or LCL recovery time, and that's probably, I did a grade 3 MCL. I had probably about a 3 month till I was back up and running, and that was 20 years ago. So they're probably, if it was something along those lines, you're in much better situation than ACL, PCL, where, like you're saying, you're looking, you know, 7 month at minimum recovery time. So that would put him not in the backup role and likely move Jacoby and Morgan or Dan Vellari into said backup role. So
not what you want.
No, not ideal.
So I do think that there were a lot of people out there who, after Schrader's performance this past year, were hoping that Lampson would challenge him in a way that would live up to Lampson's Eric Dungy 2.0 billing that came with his recruitment, because that was a thing for some reason. But now that Lampson is definitively going to be missing a significant portion of time, I cannot imagine that he would be in a position to challenge Schrader out of the gate unless Schrader got hurt or was remarkably terrible. So it looks like Garrett Schrader is your definitive starting quarterback for the Syracuse Orange heading into this season. I know that's not going to make some people happy, but that's the reality of the situation with this injury for sure.
Seems right. Yep. I mean, there's no other way to slice it.
Christian seems so happy.
Oh, God, just absolutely thrilled by the sequence of events that's happening right now.
The best case scenario is that Garrett Schrader has fixed his issues and we don't have to worry about the backup quarterback till next year. But, you know, Syracuse can't have nice things.
I'm still holding out hope based on the limited stuff we saw in the spring practice. He threw balls that were not into the turf or over people's heads by 7 million yards. So even in warmups, I'll take that.
I was going to say, the reason that I don't have faith is less on Schrader and more on the ridiculous schedule that Syracuse has found itself in. However, it's looking like that type of scheduling, at least from an ACC perspective, could be fundamentally changing. David Hale, who is just the guy to follow if you want ACC news, he has basically been posting a lot of interviews and a lot of different conversations with people around the ACC while they're doing their offseason meetings. And it appears as if the ACC is very much considering changing the way that they schedule in-conference football games. Now, David goes on a very long-winded, but still incredibly informative discussion about why they're looking to do this, what challenges the ACC is facing. But we want to start with this basic thing. It's called a 3-5-5 scheduling model. But the reality
is confused with a 3-3-5 defense, like Andy just said.
Right. Well, in reality, it probably should be called a 3-3-5 model because I had to ask Kevin about this in the main Slack channel because I couldn't understand why they call it a 3-3-5 schedule. But I'm looking for the actual message. It's three permanent rivals, and then you have five on and five off. So you get, for example, say we do 2023 and 2025. You'd play the same three teams in 2023 and 2024, and then the other five would flip and rotate each year. So in order to get the homes and aways, there's definitely some like finagling that has to be done. You probably have to, it's not going to be perfectly balanced year to year, but it's probably balanced in the aggregate. It's an interesting way of approaching the schedule, especially for a team like Syracuse that is locked into a division where you have to play Florida State, you have to play Clemson, and there's really no historical reason for Syracuse to be locked into a series with Clemson and Florida State long term. I think from that perspective, I'm very happy of it. The trickier part becomes, who are the three teams that Syracuse gets locked up with? Because I think we all would say, give us Pitt, give us BC, give us insert other Big East school that's in the Northeast, Northeast-ish, so that way we don't necessarily have to be making these trips down to Florida or South Carolina to get our asses beat consistently every year. I'm down for that. That being said, Steve kind of brought, Kevin brought up a really interesting point, is that there are probably other teams like a Clemson, like a Miami, that would love to have Syracuse on the schedule as a permanent rival because it's a baked-in, easier game. And there's less volatility that way. I'm intrigued by all this. Christian, I'm interested on your thoughts just because it seems apparent Syracuse is going to schedule non-conference games that we don't like from now until the end of time.
Hockey update, shorthanded goal, 3-2 Pittsburgh.
I'm seeing the Yeah, okay. Anyways, Christian, talk scheduling while I geek out.
So, in a logical sense, Virginia Tech makes the most sense. From a Syracuse and logical geographical sense, Virginia Tech makes the most sense as the third rival. Now, whether money makes things different is a completely different thing as well. But I honestly, I'm like 50-50 on this. I'm not sure because if like the three permanent rivals thing is like an okay thing. I think it is. I just don't know. It's so tough.
I mean, I think it's better than having the what?
It's better,
six that we have
it's better
now?
Than the division. It's better than the divisions. It's just what's the I think everyone agrees, and that's why you're seeing the and that's why you're seeing these conversations happening right now, is that everyone agrees that the divisions is just not a great strategy right now, just in general. So people are still trying to come up with creative ways to do that, and I'm not sure what the best way is either. So while it's a good strategy,
Yeah.
I think that's how we kind of all feel. Like, yes, it's a solution, but is it the solution we want necessarily? Probably not. It's just so weird.
I still think pods are the way to go. The Bill C method of clumping schools together, either by regionality or by history, and then just having a pod rotation. The 3-5-5 is very similar to that, where essentially you're doing a bunch of circumferencing pods around each other. But it does make the 3-5-5 gives you more flexibility, just because the five on and the five off allow for a lot more home and away matchups that work based off of what other schools are scheduling. But I just want Clemson and Florida State off of the schedule consistently. Same with Louisville. Like, I have no affinity towards Louisville as an old Big East rival. Don't care about them at all. Pitt and BC are the only two teams that I want to see every year that are in the ACC. Everybody else to me is meh. Give me the best opportunity for the Orange to go and get six wins.
Right. And I don't think you guys brought up the point earlier about all those big names want us on the schedule as a quote unquote easy win. I probably shouldn't even quote unquote that, because, well, at this point, it is an easy win. There's some merit into, if we're going to get stuck with one of the big boys, who do you want to get stuck with? And, you know, do you opt for something like Miami, where we have a lot of recruiting ties to? Do you opt for, you know, Florida State or Clemson out of, yeah, we're going to get our butts kicked, but we at least have some name recognition there, or we're guaranteed to be on a non-nooner slot type thing. You know, current Florida State notwithstanding, there's a big asterisk there, but I don't know. It's, if you go to a true pods model, you get, and Andy, you'll understand. Well, yeah, you will too, Christian. You end up in a bit of a weird unbalanced situation, kind of like MLS, and how the regular season is just kind of funky and doesn't quite work. Whereas this at least gets you seeing most of the league every other year, as opposed to the current situation where it's whoever's in the Coastal, you play once every you play an away game once every 14 years there. So it puts you in a really weird spot.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point, where outside, like, the NFL has figured out divisions really well, and that's because they do really small divisions. And if you think about it, the NFL scheduling is really just pods. You've got 16 really small, hyper-geographically located teams that you have a preset schedule around every year. It's a really great way of doing things. Major League Baseball, you play so many games in the division format, basically works, because with a 162 game data set, it allows you to do a lot more balancing out of the schedule, especially over time. But yeah, in college football, these whole huge conference and then huge division things that popped up because of post realignment, it just doesn't really make any sense. And I don't love the Big 12's, like, you know, round robin, winner take all marketing thing that they do around playing like a traditional college football schedule. So I think the recruiting thing is probably the biggest piece of this puzzle. If we're going to get stuck with somebody, I'd rather get stuck with somebody either down in Florida or even a Georgia Tech. I think Georgia Tech's dance card would be pretty full, to be honest. But if we could get into that Atlanta area, if we can get into Florida, I would love Virginia Tech, but I don't think our staff has done a great job of recruiting the DMV area, and the DMV area has also fundamentally shifted in recruiting bases. It's all really interesting. The other part of this scheduling conversation that I want to tag on is, did either of you read David's entire thread about the ACC meetings and about the, for lack of a better word, financial dick measuring contest that's happening between the Big 12 or the Big 10, the Big 10, the SEC, and everybody else?
No, this sounds interesting.
TLDR for everybody else at home, and then for you two, so this is actually perfect. The expanding gap between the Big Ten, SEC, and everybody else is fundamentally scaring college administrators, because there's no realistic fix for the ACC, the Big 12, or the Pac-12 to have any sort of gains on the Big Ten or the SEC's revenues. Every fix that you offer is a short-term few million dollar fix that the Big Ten and the SEC will make up in just yearly growth year to year. So the questions of these scheduling changes came from a desire for the ACC to be more flexible should the Big Ten want some kind of alliance of some kind. And it sounds like the ACC is trying to angle itself to be a natural companion to the Big Ten in most competitions, as a way of latching on to some of their adjacent revenue streams. Naturally, as you can imagine, this brought upon the conversation of, when do these schools just break away from the NCAA because the money's too good? And that question is answered based off of who you ask. But I thought it was a really interesting idea, given that Penn State and Syracuse just announced a future long-term schedule. So my brain is starting to connect things, and I wonder if we start to see the Big Ten and the ACC start to merge their schedules together, and if that's the case, I hate every single second of it.
You know why? Because that means we're going to see a lot of the State University of New Jersey.
Oh, we are going to see so much Rutgers, so much Maryland. Like, oh.
I love New Jersey, but like I said in a previous podcast quite a while ago, no one in New Jersey likes to acknowledge the existence of the State University of New Jersey unless you're an alum of the State University of New Jersey. And even then, most of them do not acknowledge the athletics of the State University of New Jersey.
Steve, you just seem so unhappy when I started laying all of that out and I mentioned a Syracuse Big Ten alliance. You looked more visibly upset than I did when I read the thread.
Yeah, it's just the whole concept of, like, what are we doing? What are we doing with this whole scheduling thing? What are we doing with all these alliances? Like, I don't know. Blow it all up, start over. I don't know.
I'm kind of in that boat as well. I feel like we've gotten to the point of no return where the SEC kind of just rules the world and everybody's just trying to get their one team to take on whoever the SEC puts forward. Not that I dislike it. I think that, again, if you're listening to this podcast this deep in about college football, you understand that college football is not necessarily about following a team that's going to win the national title every year. So that is something that I think is a framework that works and the one that I choose to enjoy with college football. But that being said, the inequality is getting remarkably to a point where I don't think it can be managed in any sort of way.
If they turned on this podcast at the beginning, they follow a team that they know is not going to make the college football playoff every year.
That is also true.
Unless they only like Syracuse lacrosse. In that case, you know, they probably could have turned off after a while.
Mazel tov to you. I wish I could live that life, but I do not. But speaking of which, we are now in the second intermission between the Penguins and Rangers game. I'm going to call this podcast early so I can go scream at my TV. Thank you to everybody who tuned in and listened to this week's edition of Troy Newton's an Absolute Podcast. Thank you for downloading this episode from whatever podcast application you use. Please make sure to rate us, review us, and subscribe us so that way we can trick the algorithm into expanding the Ottoman Empire. Thank you again to everybody who watched on our Twitch live stream. Remember, we do this pretty much every Sunday at 8 p.m. So if you want to catch the podcast earlier before everybody else, watch my insane reactions to whatever sporting event is going on live at the time. You get to watch those. And for everybody who's watching or reading this on nudesmagician.com, thank you again. We really do appreciate you coming back to the site and supporting all of our wonderful writing staff. Thank you to our home field apparel sponsors. Again, promo code Nunes, N-U-N-E-S, for 10% off your first order. I think that's all the spiel.
Seems right.
Cool. Thank you again, Christian. Thank you again, Steve, and Steve, for producing this wonderful show. Thank you for all those who listen in. Go Orange.
Orange.
Go Orange.